Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. On the final full day of the Trump presidency, Donald Trump leaves the presidency at noon tomorrow. Josh Kroshauer from the National Journal joins me on what will really be the final podcast, well, I think the final podcast of the Trump presidency. So, Josh, I mean, it has been a wild ride, hasn't it?
Well, thanks, Charlie. It's an honor to be on this momentous occasion, the final day, final full day of Trump's presidency. But it's been a long, wild ride. And I don't know if we're fully going to be divorced from Trump even after he leaves office.
So I want to get to some like really deep thoughts and great historical perspective in a moment. But I want to look at the moment that we're at right now where, you know, Washington looks like an armed camp. It's got a green zone. I mean, it does look like downtown Baghdad and, you know, from some pictures. Also, we find out that the MyPillow guy has been banned from Bed Bath & Beyond and Kohl's for his role in the insurrection. I mean, which is like one of these crazy things that, you know, people looking back on and say, so the day before Trump leaves office, you're talking about the MyPillow guy. Yeah, because that's the kind of thing that's going on. This shouldn't be a big story, but it's still kind of extraordinary that we found out a little while ago that Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, will be going to church to pray with Joe Biden before the inauguration. You know what I mean, Josh? It's just like a moment of what was once routine graciousness now goes, wow, that's a little bit. That's almost jarring, considering, you know, the mood right now where the First Lady is not meeting with the incoming First Lady. Donald Trump is not even speaking to Joe Biden. He's not going to the inauguration. There's not going to be a tea. There's not going to be a ride together. So it does feel like kind of a throwback, doesn't it, that Mitch McConnell is actually going to be praying with Joe Biden?
Yeah, I mean, you've laid out the two contrasting presidencies. And it goes to show that the president in our American system, the president does shape the politics, shapes the culture. The president is the straw that stirs the political drink. And you see with the MyPillow guy that it's sort of the final last straw of the Trump administration, empowering some of the biggest crackpots in American political and business life. And you also see Republicans coming to terms with the reality of a new administration, one that pledged normalcy in American political life. And you see Republicans, McConnell going to church with Biden tomorrow. A lot of Republicans I've talked to almost wanting to black hole the last 4 years, wanting to forget the legacy of Trump, forget the chaos and the craziness of the last 5 years. And, you know, look, we have short memories in America, you know, the way, you know, we consume information, you know, a day is a lifetime. And, you know, Republicans right. are going to try to move beyond what we just have seen. And Democrats, I don't know if they'll let them do that, but that'll be one of the big storylines.
Well, of course,
opening months.
Yeah. One of the strange storylines, of course, there's so many unprecedented things that are happening or close to unprecedented. And we've overused that word over the last 4 years, is that normally you just close the door on the outgoing president. But of course, you have the inauguration and then the beginning of the Senate trial of Donald Trump. So we are definitely not done with Donald Trump. I would be remiss if I did not mention that this is also the day, you want to talk about symbolism, you know, the collision of worlds. Not only is this the final full day of the Trump administration, but we've crossed the threshold of 400,000 American deaths from the coronavirus, 400,000 deaths. Now, this has been projected for some time that you might reach that by the inauguration day, but it is just an extraordinary milestone and just a, you know, you talk about, you know, the real, you know, monuments to the failure of this administration. If somebody would have said last April that you'd have 400,000 dead Americans by January 20th, people would have thought, oh my God, that's the most alarmist possible timeline.
Yeah, when we look at the history of the Trump administration years from now, the pivot point is going to be the Trump administration, especially Trump himself, his absolute unwillingness to grapple with the reality of what was going on in the country with the pandemic. And I think it affected him politically. I think you could create an alternative history where if Trump even took the crisis remotely seriously, if he didn't talk about it, you know, injecting bleach, if he didn't, you know, refuse to wear masks and make that a sign of right-wing symbolism, you could have seen Trump winning a second term. You could have seen a different outcome in the election. But ultimately, not only did that doom him politically, but it's just created this, you know, alternative right-wing ecosystem where facts, reality, even people like dying, right, you know, in neighborhoods and communities across the country was unwilling. It was unable to change a lot of people's minds because they were stuck in certain Trump-fueled, you know, alternative reality.
Well, that's a great segue, Josh, into the alternative reality. Before we get into our deep thoughts about all of this, the alternative reality folks over at Fox News are not handling this well. And I think one of the big questions was, when Trump leaves, will they try to move back toward, you know, a little bit closer to sanity, or are they going to double down because they're under pressure from, you know, the real tinfoil hat folks over at OAN and Newsmax? And do not underestimate, you know, this as a dynamic that you don't want to be outflanked on the crazy, apparently, on the right. So Sean Hannity last night was peak Sean in predicting what's going to happen now that the Democrats are moving into the White House. Here's Sean Hannity from last night.
Education camps, deprogramming. Okay, according to the press wing of the Democratic Establishment Party and the Socialist Party, you, we, the people, we need to be deprogrammed or canceled or put in re-education camps because of our political opinion, and it differs from theirs. Sadly, after decades on TV and radio, let me just tell you what this is really all about. Now, this effort from the left, it is not new. It's only accelerating. I'm not complaining, but this has really been my reality in radio.
Okay, so okay, I missed it, Josh. A lot of stuff going on. Re-education camps, is that part of the Biden agenda?
Well, this is sort of this before the riot of the last week. The playbook for the Republican Party was to dwell on Democrat extremes, progressive. Sure. The worst, and that was sort of the play. I mean, I wrote about it in my column this week. One of the more pragmatic former Republican members of Congress, you know, thinking about running for the Senate, preparing a playbook where you focus on what he called pronoun progressivism.
I love that. I love this. Is Ryan Costello is running in Pennsylvania, and he's talking about running against a progressive Democrat who is. Use the term pronoun progressive. So first of all, Josh, what is a pronoun progressive?
Well, look, this, as he put it, it's an obsession with identity politics, cancel culture. Sean Hannity may be on the right wing of Republican politics, but these are issues that actually unite a lot of different factions within the Republican Party. And frankly, we're very compelling arguments for Republicans in the last election, why Republicans overachieved. In the Senate and the House, and in talking about defunding the police, talking about cancel culture, talking about, you know, trying to rewrite the history of the country, the 1619 Project. A lot of those staples have been the most effective arguments for Republicans to unite their party, even though Trump, you know, try to ignore the reality of the elephant in the room. The problem, though, is that when you can talk about defunding the police all you want, you know, this month we saw Trump supporters. A mob of Trump supporters killing a policeman at the Capitol.
Yeah, right? that would seem to be an off message.
I mean, this is Republicans, I think, believe that they can kind of wish the last few weeks away and try to move beyond Trump. But there is footage, there is, you know, evidence. And anytime Republicans try to talk about, you know, law enforcement, law and order, defunding the police, all Democrats need to do is point to the video of rioters that supported Trump mobbing the Capitol and injuring dozens of policemen and killing one. So, you know, this is the moment we're in where you're seeing Republicans resort to the most extremes of the Democratic left as a way to unite the party again.
Right.
But I don't know if it's that easy. I think that we January 6th was a seminal moment in our politics.
I want to go back beyond that. And I want to come back to this. See, when I listen to Hannity, I mean, you know what the playbook is, but I'm guessing that unless you are like really, really, really deep into MAGA, you're going to kind of roll your eyes, the re-education camps and all of this stuff. Yeah, exactly. That's what's going to happen. I mean, it's one thing to say, hey, these guys are spending a lot of money, or, you know, they have some, you know, some crazy, you know, social justice ideas or whatever it is that they want to say. Hannity seems to figure that let's use the scariest, most bizarre rhetoric. Okay, so before we're done with the speaking of the alternative reality, Maria Bartiromo has been on Fox Business, has been one of the worst purveyors of conspiracy theories of the big lie. You know, when we look back on the history of January 6th, as I've said over and over again, you know, the big lie is the incitement. I think it's a mistake, and I know I've said this before, but I want to keep emphasizing it. It's a mistake just to focus on the words spoken by the president and others on January 6th. I think they did incite the riot. There's no question about it. But the larger incitement was spreading the big lie that this election had been stolen. There was a conspiracy, and Maria Bartiromo is very much a part of this story. Bizarrely enough, Fox News apparently is going to promote her now and let her try out for the 7 o'clock hour on Fox News, move her over from Fox Business, which suggests to me that the folks running Fox News are not chagrined at all about their role in this disinformation. And here's Maria Bartiromo either this morning or last night. Let's play this.
Well, security in the nation's capital is at an unprecedented level this morning ahead of the inauguration tomorrow. A new report says that some far-right protesters have discussed posing as members of the National Guard to infiltrate the inauguration the way Democrats infiltrated 2 weeks ago and put on MAGA clothing. Acting Secretary of Defense Chris Miller says that there is no intelligence about a potential insider threat to the inauguration.
Okay, that's just bullshit. I mean, this is like the dead ender thing that those people who were very, very clearly MAGA types. No. They were really those false flag. It strikes me, Josh, that stuff that would have been confined to the Alex Jones conspiracy theorists, you know, the fever swamp. Now you're starting to hear it on places like Fox Business and Fox News.
Well, you know, what's really interesting in the last few weeks is that we're seeing one of the aggrieved parties from all this misinformation, the Dominion company, the run for voting machines, are now suing the folks who are spouting off lies. And, you know, a lot of this is just, it's very sad, but there's a market for this misinformation, disinformation, falsehoods. And that we're in this like broken system. It's not just in the media, but it's in the world of politics where you have Republicans who, by the way, when you look at the exit polls in November, 81% of Americans and a majority of Trump supporters said the elections were free and fair. Mm-hmm. And then after 2 months of Trump's Twitter, propaganda, now you see where the Republican Party is. There is a market for this stuff, and that's why you see some of the things you're seeing in the world of media. But the reality is, what's going to be fascinating is when you have Dominion suing some of the worst perpetrators of misinformation and putting an actual cost on lies. It's going to be interesting to see how that changes the dynamic, because a lot of this is just about money and about self-interest and about ratings and so on. But if there's a real cost that is on the other side, when you can't just slander a company and make up lies about it, and if courts rule in Dominion's favor, that could be a moment where you start to see the winds shift a little bit.
I think so. Actually, this, I'm really glad you brought this up, because, you know, this is sort of a bad case scenario of how bad, you know, how damaging disinformation can be, the way that it's spread, that the fact that you have an overwhelming majority now of Republicans who believe the election was stolen. And look, there were a lot of people involved in this. A lot of politicians were involved and were complicit in this. Fox News, talk radio, a lot of those folks. So Mona Chern has a great piece about this. All of the folks that were involved in propagating the lie. But there's two developments that I think are interesting. I mean, obviously, the social media platforms pushing back, canceling some of these, I'm not going to use their word, deplatforming some of the worst actors, including Donald Trump. So there's a new study out showing that online misinformation declined by 73% after Donald Trump was removed from Twitter. I mean, that's kind of amazing that you remove Donald Trump from Twitter and 73% of the online misinformation goes away. So this raises the possibility that maybe we can combat this. Yeah, I mean, you know, the worst guys are going to go off to Gab or Parler, but at least you're not going to be snagging somebody on Pinterest or on YouTube, you know, who's looking for a colonic cleanse or something, and suddenly they find themselves in QAnon or something like that. So is that a big deal? What's your reaction to that study about the 73% reduction in online misinformation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you shut down the Trump's Twitter feed, it's bound to have consequences, and I think in a positive way. You know, one thing it sort of reminds me of is when a lot of cities and states implemented smoking bans in restaurants across the country and bars and whatnot. And, you know, there was a lot of principled libertarian pushback, what Mike Bloomberg was doing, what we saw here in my home state of Virginia, that, you know, it's against the business's ability to set their own rules. It's an infringement of liberty. It's not going to do anything. People are just going to smoke in their own other businesses. But what we've seen in the last, 5 years is that smoking has gone down. You know, the rate of smoking has gone down. I mean, in fact, it's actually had a significant impact in personal behavior. So, you know, look, I think there's no doubt that these social media platforms could have been more responsible, could have set their own more stringent regulations throughout the Trump presidency. And it's not a coincidence that Trump, as Trump is leaving office, they choose, and then after January 6th, they choose to act responsibly. But, they could have done this a long time ago. And I think it's likely that it's going to have a positive effect. It's going, policing your platforms and not allowing them to be a place where conspiracy theories can flourish and, threats of violence can really be mainstreamed. It's going to have a positive impact. Yes, you'll see some of the more crazy people going to other platforms, but I think you can't underestimate the sheer depth, the mainstream nature of how these QAnon and these conspiracy theories reach to the broader public. That's not just the most radical folks. It's just people who were bored during the pandemic, going on their phones and getting caught in this rabbit hole of propaganda and conspiracy theories. And I think by regulating it in a way that they are, I think it is going to have at least in the short term, a positive effect.
It's rather dramatic how big the impact is. My only question is, how much of that is just Donald Trump, and how much of that is the, tens of thousands of other, platforms that they removed. This, by the way, that we're talking about some research by something called the Signal Labs, which is a San Francisco-based analytics firm, reported that conversations about election fraud dropped from 2.5 million mentions to all the way down to 688,000 mentions across several media sites. And again, it wasn't just Trump. It was a lot of the allies and a lot of the QAnon folks that were dropped off. We shouldn't have to mention this, Josh, but I find that it's necessary to keep repeating it because so many people on the right are first playing the victim card and saying this is a massive censorship, this is Big Brother, this is Red China. We need to remind people that these are private companies, these are private platforms, and that the First Amendment applies to state action, not to that of private action. It's also very ironic that conservatives have been, absolutely adamant in not having the government tell private entities what they must do or say, right? I mean, that's the whole, baking the cake, the baker, with the gay wedding cake. And yet you're having people like Josh Hawley who would at least sound like they want to take action to have the government compel these private companies to publish things that are untrue and perhaps dangerous. So this is about moderation, moderating the content rather than censoring the content. And quite frankly, they have absolutely every right to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've kind of got sucked into this debate over free speech, whether this is free speech, not free speech. When I think the more apropos argument is where you draw the line, where private companies should draw the line in terms of acceptable speech on their platforms. Because even going back to the cancel culture arguments of the summer, I mean, the real problem that the left was facing wasn't that private company. I mean, there were certain companies that were firing people or suspending people or overreaching their authority, but it was really that the punishment didn't fit the crime. That was ultimately, people's heterodox opinions were being punished, but we're not talking about fomenting violence. We're not talking about, supporting white nationalism. And, I think ultimately, like you said, Charlie, these social media platforms, they have terms of service. They have the ability to moderate their platforms if they so chose. And, it really is a matter of where do you draw the line? And that's the heated debate between both sides. Like, what is the line you draw? And I think the left wants to draw it in a way that, censors or punishes opinion that was at one point in time, not that long ago, pretty mainstream. But, you know, I think the right wing view that you don't censor or you don't moderate, I should say, anything is also problematic, because you see what happens when you have, you know, people that adhere to QAnon and all kinds of crazy views, that how quickly that those types of views can metastasize when you don't. When private companies, when social media platforms don't do any regulation at all.
No, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the argument that this kind of power can be misused. I mean, I always feel the concentration of power ought to be regarded with skepticism, and I'm also sensitive to the slippery slope argument that you start by going after QAnon, and before long you go after, you know, anyone who has a heterodox opinion on any issue, you know, climate change, police, community relations, any of those things. Those are legitimate concerns. But I also think that there is a fundamental principle of responsible speech that we do understand, especially when we are seeing, you know, the existential threat, the disinformation and calls for violence posed to our society. You know, our support for free speech is not a suicide pact. And so I think that right now, I have, you know, in the past, I've been kind of a free speech absolutist, but now I think it is time to say, look, private entities should exercise levels of responsibility, personal responsibility, corporate responsibility. Okay, so that seems to be making a difference. I want to go back to your point, because this may be another one of the game changers, something that actually does make a difference. The Dominion lawsuit against MyPillow, against a lot of these outlets, these people could be in a lot of trouble. This could be millions of dollars, and this is, we're not in a world where you can just simply persuade people. You should tell the truth. That hammer of those lawsuits, I think is could have a dramatic effect. I mean, who knows? You know, a year from now, when you buy a voting machine, you might get a free pillow. You know, I mean, Dominion may own my pillow a year from now.
You also saw like Newsmax and even some sort of secondary websites like what's it called, the American Thinker, putting out these apologies, essentially for, you know, for spouting out nonsense on their airwaves and in
groveling apology.
Yeah, it was remarkable. And look, the biggest fear I have for society's long-term health is our ability to believe in actual truth. Like that. Yes. You're seeing on left. I mean, this is and we're seeing it right now on the right, but you know, we can talk about some of the stuff over the summer on the left. Some of the we've talked about this on the same podcast, that there's a postmodernism on the left, mm-hmm. and the right that kind of feeds off of each other. And it doesn't believe in truth. It doesn't believe in facts. It wants to create narrative, and it wants to rely on power to basically force people to believe their preferred narratives. And I think you've got to get our society back on the right track, you've just got to look at the lodestar of truth and fact and reporting and all the things we've traditionally relied on as a healthy democratic society. And you know, I think it's a project that has to be done within both parties. You can't rely on Republicans criticizing Democrats or Democrats criticizing Republicans. It'll take leaders in both parties to stand up and say we need to stand for reality, not crazy.
Yeah, to their own teams. Okay, so these three things, you know, the online crackdown, the lawsuits against the worst actors, and then of course we're seeing this story. There's a breaking news story in the Washington Post that lawmakers who objected to the election results, that would be what I call the Sedition Caucus, have been cut off from 20 of their 30 biggest corporate PAC donors. The 147 Republican lawmakers who oppose certification of the presidential election this month have lost the support of 20 of their largest corporate backers as companies continue to grapple with the recent political turmoil. Meanwhile, 9 among the 30 largest donors have not pledged a specific action, according to a Washington Post survey. But, you know, pressure is building, and we know that conscience is that small voice telling politicians that that their campaign funds might be cut off.
Yeah, money matters. It actually is interesting when you look at the fundraising figures of the last 2 years. Republicans have actually been outraised by Democrats pretty handily, even before these threats. A lot of it is also the super PAC world, where I think actually, frankly, the bigger donors, the people who can write big checks are the more important constituency in the financial world, because that's where a lot of the money, the super PAC money, went in funding ads in the biggest Senate and House races. I mean, money speaks. I mean, everyone's acting in their own self-interest. There's not a lot of morality rolling around in politics. And when you cut off one element of self-interest, the ability to raise funds to run a credible campaign, it's going to have some impact.
Okay, let's get to the deep thoughts. Let's be big thinkers here. Okay, so start off with the Wall Street Journal editorial this morning. What is the headline on this revisionist? They did their jobs well. As the Trump presidency ends in the disgrace of the Capitol riot, an effort is already underway to erase everything in the last 4 years as disgraceful too. That's a lie, a big lie, to borrow the cliche of the moment. It's not a cliche. It is a big lie. Donald Trump's profound character flaws need to be separated from what so many people in the administration accomplished for the country. And then there's another line. The Trump administration should be remembered for far more than its terrible final days. Now, I want to repeat that because that's where I want to go. The Trump administration should be remembered for far more than its terrible final days. Well, yes, of course. But Josh Krashauer, how will the Trump administration be remember, because I know it's always tempting to think of, you know, the most recent event, but it strikes me that 100 years from now, when the name, you know, Donald Trump comes up, that this is what it's going to be remembered for, the way it left office.
Well, let's just look at recent history. Do we remember Richard Nixon for the state of the economy in 1973? 1974? No. I mean, his legacy is Watergate. Do we remember Andrew Johnson for the foreign policy in the post-Civil War administration? No. I mean, the reality is
January. What was the unemployment rate under James Buchanan?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the reality is the January 6th is going to be etched in stone as part of the Trump legacy. And look, a lot of there's good and bad in every administration, even the worst presidential administrations. You know, the Abraham Accords is going to be a big accomplishment for Trump. I mean, you can talk about like deregulation all you want, but the reality is in 20, 30 years, that's not how Trump will be remembered. We'll have plenty of economic and business cycles from here on out. We'll have foreign policy accomplishments from many presidents and failures. But the reality is that when you see the first attack on the Capitol in over, since 1812, I guess, that's going to be the lead of how Trump is remembered. The fact that he fomented such grievance and such misinformation and inspired almost a cult-like devotion among his supporters, which led them to commit unthinkable acts. That's going to be what we remember Trump for. It doesn't mean that there weren't accomplishments by his administration. There are accomplishments in every administration.
Well, and it doesn't mean that there weren't other disgraceful things over the last 4 years as well. But you're right. I mean, there's no way around it, because the second impeachment, I think one of the values of it, whatever happens, is that it places this marker. And that you have to mention in, you know, any summary of the Trump administration, that he's a one-term president who was impeached twice for his actions, refused to concede, and spent his last couple of months in office trying to overturn the result of the election, refused to even attend the inauguration of his successor. I mean, that's part of the narrative, and there's no way around that, which is remarkable, because you and I have lived through this incredibly tumultuous 4 years. We think, oh my God, this is big. This is extraordinary. This is going to change things. Okay. Well, this is one of the, you know, significant moments of this administration. And all of that, I think, is pushed down by what has just happened in the last 6 to 8 weeks, maybe the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, I also think, Charlie, that what happens in the next 10 years is going to define how we look at the Trump administration's legacy. Was this a 4-year blip in history? Mm-hmm. And will we go back to a sense of normality? Will the next president that succeeds Joe Biden go and attend his will Biden attend his successor's inauguration? Will we see the norms that Trump blew through over the last 4 years restored and built up again? We don't know the answer. I mean, there are a lot of historians and analysts who think that the Trump has sort of set a precedent for bad behavior from future presidents and future administrations. I'm not so sure of that, but I mean, I think Biden, being sort of the pragmatist and the institutionalist in office, is an important reset. It was important we elected a Biden rather than a Bernie, because I think he does want to restore a lot of the institutional norms that have been gutted in the last 4 years. But I mean, I think how we look at Trump 10 years from now will depend on how future administrations handle and react to the last 4 years.
You know, and there's always a revisionism that takes place after a president leaves office. I think, you know, most famously, Jimmy Carter, who I think was at the time regarded as a somewhat weak president, a flawed president, but had this remarkable post-presidency. It's hard to imagine a post-presidency of Donald Trump that is going to completely turn around his image. In fact, he's going to be the first, well, not the first, but at least in recent political history, the first completely pariah ex-president. Even Richard Nixon managed not to be a complete pariah with his post-presidency. But I think it's hard to imagine Trump turning it around. Especially, honestly, you know, if as reported, he completely and totally believes that this election was stolen from him, then he's going to go off into a sulking exile where he's going to stew with his bitterness. He's going to be sitting there watching television, tweeting on Parler or whatever you do on Parler. So it's kind of hard for me to imagine that he's not going to be a statesman. He's not going to be a philanthropist. He's not. What is he going to do?
Well, we also don't know, Charlie, how long-lasting the Republican Party's voters' ties to Trump will last. That's actually been sort of a running discussion on this
sure.
podcast.
Very much so.
I was more sanguine. I actually thought, this is before January 6th, I thought being a former president, not having the power of the office, would automatically kind of diminish his influence within the party. I think January 6th showed the rot was very, very deep. That the degree to which even your average rank and file Republican who doesn't really, you know, subscribe to any of the craziness, you know, they believe that the election may have been stolen. Like the rot of Trump's lies ran deeper, I think, than even I anticipated. But weirdly, the fact that you had this crisis moment where Republicans are now breaking from the president, and you're even looking at some public opinion polls showing, you know, his support within the party dipping 10, 20 points in the last few weeks. You know, I think it's more likely now that Trump is more discredited even within the party, that you won't see a lot of Republicans looking to tie themselves to Trump running for future office, perhaps outside of the deepest red districts and states.
And yet, what is more likely? That the Republican Party will purge itself of the QAnon conspiracy sedition caucus nut jobs, or that the Republican Party will purge out the people like Liz Cheney and the Republican member of the Board of Canvassing in Michigan, or the governor of Georgia, the guys that did the right thing? Because I'm looking around the country right now and seeing there's going to be, you know, primary challenges against Liz Cheney, probably move to remove her from the chairman of the caucus in Arizona. They are censuring Cindy McCain and the Governor Ducey. So, in a coin flip, I think it's more likely that they're going to purge the people who stood up against Trump than the Lauren Bobbitts and Marjorie Taylor Greens and Paul Gosars of the Republican Party.
Yeah, I think you've laid out the biggest political test over the next 2 years. Is it more likely that Republicans expel some of the most extreme members who have ties to these groups like QAnon?
Yeah.
Or is it more likely that someone like Liz Cheney or Peter Mayer, the representative from Michigan, end up losing primaries in 2 years? I think you're right. I think that right now, if the elections were held today, Liz Cheney would lose a primary in Wyoming. Peter Mayer would lose a primary in Michigan. But I also think that 2 years is a lifetime in politics. And there is a mood, and this is Jonathan Last has written quite a bit about this in the Bulwark, whether you believe the institutionalists have the most influence or whether the grassroots, the voters, have the most influence. I think the question is, do Republicans move on from Trump if he's not constantly tweeting, if he's less of a player in the post presidential world? I think in these red states and red districts, like Wyoming is one of the most Republican states in the country, Liz Cheney's in serious trouble in a primary. On the other hand, there are a lot of swing or even Republican leaning states and districts where Trump's latest where Trump has seen his numbers collapse, and his legacy is going to be much more negative. And Ryan Costello is an interesting figure because he represents the state of Pennsylvania, still a swing state. The Republican Party in Pennsylvania has evolved from being a suburban party to a rural small town party where Trump is very, very popular. So, I mean, like watching Ryan Costello, if he decides to run for the Senate and seeing if he can make it out of a primary in Pennsylvania, I think that'll be an interesting test because Republicans couldn't win Georgia before January 6th. They lost two very winnable seats in Georgia before the riots because simply Trump denied the legitimate election results. It's only gotten worse since then. So, you know, Republicans, they can't win with him, they can't win without him, but now the cost of campaigning alongside Trump is a lot more severe, a lot more significant. And, you know, I think they're going to muddle through these next 2 years trying to figure out some middle way, but it's not going to be easy.
So things have moved so quickly that some major developments, I think, have almost gotten lost. It's been, how many weeks has it been? It's Tuesday, right? I've lost track here. It's Tuesday. So was it 3 weeks ago today that we had the Georgia runoffs?
Yeah, January 5th. So almost about two weeks away.
No. It was 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, it's hard to believe. It feels like years ago, right?
That is crazy.
But you know, that goes to show that like 2 years in politics, you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, that a lot of things are going to happen in the next year. Biden's going to control the agenda. I mean, we can't predict how the Republican Party is going to evolve because there's just a lot of unknown unknowns.
Okay, so that was a I was surprised by that. I will admit that. So if I had to bet 2 weeks ago, right now, I would have said the Republicans are going to win both of those seats, and the Republicans are going to control the Senate, and they're just going to make Joe Biden's life completely miserable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that didn't happen. Your shorthand version before, because I want to move on from this, but your shorthand version, why Democrats won in Georgia, why Republicans lost unlosable seats in Georgia in a runoff?
Well, I think the most fundamental lesson is when your party is divided, you lose elections. I mean, that's just the simple lesson. And McConnell and Republican strategists wanted to keep the Kraken in coalition with the more traditional Republicans. But it came at a severe cost because it forced Kelly Loeffler to publicly proclaim she wanted to throw out the election results in Georgia the night before the vote. And that had a cost. It had a cost in her election. It had a cost, you know, politically and what happened the day after. You know, David Perdue, who was a business guy, transformed into a Trumpist. And that was costly as well. When you look at the numbers, Charlie, just really quickly, two things happened to the Republican Party in Georgia. Their voters didn't show up in the rural, most Trumpy parts of the state. There was a notable drop off, especially in North Georgia, where the most conservative voters live. And there was a small but perceptible decline in support for both Perdue and Loeffler in the suburbs, in the Cobb County, in the wealthier suburban areas that had voted for Perdue and voted for Republicans down ballot in November. But this Trump craziness was simply too much for them, for enough of them to stomach. And a few of them, a small critical mass of them, moved to vote Democratic in January. That's what you're going to see across the country, Charlie, if they don't purge themselves of the Trump taint.
Well, this is what was so extraordinary, because normally Republicans in Georgia do extremely well because of the turnout in a runoff. So this goes to the question of what happens in the midterms. The conventional wisdom is always that the party out of power does very, very well in the midterms. But I wonder whether or not the formula has been scrambled. Let me just think about Wisconsin here. In Wisconsin, traditionally, before the last couple of cycles, Democrats did very, very well in the big turnout general elections, and Republicans did very well in the lower turnout midterm elections. So, much of the Republican sweep took place in the off-year elections. But now you're seeing these massive turnouts among Democrats that have changed the formula. And if you have any weakness at all with the Republicans, you see in Wisconsin, it's really very much the same story. You had, huge turnouts of the Democratic base in Wisconsin, erosion in the suburbs, and Donald Trump and the other Republicans just simply weren't able to overcome it. So 2018, Scott Walker is ousted as governor. Tammy Baldwin, the incumbent Democratic senator, wins by double digits. 2016, Donald Trump loses Wisconsin. So you go to 2022, And I think the assumption has been that this is going to be a really, really good year for the Republicans. But if Ron Johnson runs for re-election as senator, he's got this national target on his back. It becomes a nationalized election. And if I'm a Republican in Wisconsin, you know, I have to be thinking that, well, are we going to see a completely new turnout model? If we stay divided and the Democrats stay that motivated, then maybe the off year election in states like Wisconsin are not going to be, are not going to be what the conventional wisdom suggests.
Yeah, Charlie, usually when a party is out of power, they benefit in the first midterm election of the opposing president. But there are some notable red flags or exceptions to that rule. And you noted one of them. It used to be Republicans would rely on sort of the civic-minded suburban voters who would they leaned Republican. They would show up in midterm elections, and they gave Republicans a midterm boost compared to presidential elections in recent years. Now, the Republican Party is predominantly the voters are predominantly in small towns and rural areas. They're tied to Trump. They're less likely to show up when he's not on the ballot. So there's that big caveat. Trump remaining in the background. I mean, we'll see how much of a factor Trump plays in the post-presidency, but he's still going to be a factor to turn out Democrats, I believe. And right. So the notion that Democrats are going to be, you know, disillusioned or they're not going to show up like they do in out of power, I'm not sure if that dynamic holds. And again, the most importantly, and this is the biggest factor, the Republican Party is likely going to be in the middle of a civil war in the next couple of years, where the MAGA faction is going to go crazy over Republicans who voted to certify the election, who don't pledge their loyalty to Trump, even out of office. So you may not just see primary challenges against someone like Liz Cheney, but you could see primary challenges against senators like Rob Portman or John Thune in the Senate. You could see you have a lot of open seats in the Senate that are very important races, North Carolina and Pennsylvania, first and foremost. So like, Donald Trump's daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, sounds like she wants to run for the Senate in North Carolina. There's already a well-known Republican former congressman that's in that race. There are going to be literally Trump family members running against more mainstream Republicans. And that is going to be a messy, messy battle that's not going to be easy to paper over once you head to the November general election. And these are important races. These are going to be the races that determine the next Senate majority.
So I think you probably have already touched on this, but your piece in the National Journal this week that the riots will cost the GOP their natural advantage in 2022. With the caveat, the 2 years is a lifetime. So just walk me through it. Is it just the law and order issue that they've taken away from the Republicans, that the Republicans are going to have a harder time, running as the party that we back, the blue, after the riots, or has it changed the dynamic in some other way that will affect the midterms?
Well, number one, the Republican Party used to be the party of stability, of sanity, of good governance, of fiscal prudence, right? I mean, that's the party that you belong to. It's the one that a lot of suburban voters once associated with. And that's now long. It was gone before January 6th, but, you know, having a bunch of MAGA hat-wearing mobsters heading to the Capitol and vandalizing the place and murdering and injuring police officers, that brand is, I think, maybe not permanently tarnished, but it's forever changed. And that is going to be on the minds of a lot of voters, especially the suburban voters that Republicans do need to make inroads with in the next election.
Yeah.
But I also think that, like I said before, there's going to be a divide, a civil war of sorts within the Republican Party as well. I don't think that it's going to be easy to paper over the differences at this point, now that Trump is out of power, now that this coalition of convenience is no longer, you know, McConnell has no need for Trump anymore, and Trump has no need to protect Republicans to keep himself, with a congressional Republican majority. So, I mean, there's going to be knives out on both sides of the Republican party, and that's going to get ugly. And that's going to, just like in Georgia, the Republican divisions that were less out in the open, that cost Republicans these two Senate seats in Georgia. I think you could see a lot of more Democratic states, more friendly states for Democrats, become much more much more winnable these races, like in North Carolina and Pennsylvania, if these divisions continue in the next 2 years.
Well, and there's also the matter of political hygiene. That if you want to be a successful party, you need to do something about your toxic elements. And the worst thing that could happen for the Republican Party right now is for the Marjorie Taylor Greens to become the face of the party. I thought Ben Sasse's piece in the Atlantic was very interesting. He's sort of drawing a line, saying, "Look, we're gonna have this moment of choosing here. You know, we're gonna either be the party of QAnon and crazy and the Proud Boys and all of this stuff, or we're going to return to be a party of sanity. And that's going to require a fight. And I don't know that the Republican Party right now has the will to purge, cleanse, weed itself of the nut jobs. And I don't think that the worst is over. I've talked about this on my podcast for some time. I think that people underestimate how deeply many of the MAGA folks believed that Donald Trump was going to win this election, and that each one of these dates is a huge shock and disillusion for them. There are still folks out there, I don't know how many, who think that tomorrow is going to be the big day, that he's going to stay. He's not. But you think about, I actually had a kind of a snarky tweet about all of this, which is actually snarky, but also substantive. You and I both have watched, you know, how the MAGA universe has reacted to the election, that they were absolutely convinced early on, remember, that the Supreme Court justices that Donald Trump had named were going to save him. They just were absolutely counting on them to do it, and that didn't happen. And then they were counting on these Republican legislatures to step up, and that didn't happen. And then a lot of them thought it was going to be the Kraken that there was going to be all this evidence of this, you know, terrible fraud. That didn't happen. You know, and then it gets more and more desperate with, you know, the president trying to get secretaries of state to overturn the election. And, you know, a week ago, 2 weeks ago, we had much of the Republican Party honestly believe that Mike Pence was going to unilaterally determine the outcome of the election, that Mike Pence was going to be the savior. And that didn't happen. And then we got to this point where, and people are going to think I'm exaggerating this, there's an undertow to a lot of the sort of right wing memes. You see it from you know, people like Kurt Schlichter's of the world, which is that, you know, you don't want a civil war because we're the tough guys, we have all the guns. I think Trump at one point said, you know, we have all the guys with the guns. And now they're kind of, at least for the moment, they're going, oh shit, these guys have tanks and drones and and bigger guns than we do. So I just don't know how this is going to play out. But the one through line is that they get increasingly unhinged and extreme in what they're prepared to do. And so I don't think that this ends tomorrow.
Well, let's hope. I think this is where the social media platforms really come into play, because don't underestimate the impact of people being home for a year, stuck in their houses, staring at their phones, and literally, you know, I think that Trump has been the arsonist in chief, lighting matches where there was a lot of fuel already existent. But, you know, when you have a bunch of people losing their jobs, being at home, staring at phones where you get the most extreme content pushed to you by the social media platforms, that created this perfect scenario, this perfect storm. I am worried about the next 6 months. You know, I do think that we're in a very, very volatile time in our country's history. Let's hope that the leaders, the institutions, get their act together and work to kind of tamp down on the flames. But, you know, I do think that Trump is losing his political oxygen. No, Twitter, mm-hmm. Twitter shutting his feed down was the capstone to that. But, you know, I think we'll see him getting less attention, a lot less attention out of office.
You know, I got
to have a big role.
I am surprised. I'm genuinely surprised how effective that shutdown was. I mean, the man has the biggest bully pulpit in the world, and yet his spokesmen are out there going, he just can't get his message up because he's not on Twitter. Really? Seriously? But apparently in his head, he can't figure out how to do this. He can't figure out how to do what he did without that platform. So I would have said, okay, yeah, you shut him down. He's just going to do something else. He's going to go somewhere else. I mean, he's the president. You can't shut him up. But apparently it's been effective. Josh Grachauer, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. It is going to be it's been an amazing 2 weeks. I think this week is going to be amazing as well. And it's only Tuesday. So thanks for coming back on the podcast, Josh.
Thanks, Charlie. Great to be on.
And thank you for joining me on this this Bulwark podcast, the final podcast of the full day of the Trump presidency. I'm guessing that we'll have a podcast. Well, I know we'll have a podcast tomorrow. So that will that be the final day of the Trump presidency? You'll have to tune in. We will be back tomorrow and we will do this all over again.